This week in the markets, investors poured back into U.S. shares, sending the Dow Jones flying 1,252 points on big expectations over the weekend G20 meeting between Trump and China's Jinping. Well, welcome back, everyone. Chris Walczyk here with you on this November 30th, Season 13, Episode 672 show. Well, hat tip to yours truly for calling the bottom in the Dow Jones Industrials last week, which plunged 1,100 points, ending at the lows and officially wiping out this year's gains. It turned right around this week, erasing losses, as I mentioned, and then some. So is this the much-anticipated Santa Claus rally, or will the Grinch steal the holiday cheer at this weekend's G20 meeting in Argentina? Joining me with their thoughts on the precious metals sector, Peter Schiff, head of Schiff Gold Euro-Pacific, joins the show from his vacation office in tropical Crypto Rico, where air conditioning, not heating, brr, is the chief concern today. He thinks gold is building a base that will take us to new highs at 2,000 to even 5,000 and maybe 10,000 on a runaway market condition. We discuss how to make America great again. Then Bob Hoy returns to the show with his latest outlook on the precious metals, and he's now a big fan of the XAU. That's right, after years of being bearish on the precious metals sector, Bob Hoy now is gaga for gold, especially the equities. We've seen GLD have a surge in assets. That's the largest ETF for the yellow metal. Up 472 million inflows on the month. That's a big plus. Then a good friend of the show, Nick Barashev, whose book is titled $10,000 Gold, is recovering from an illness. So if you'd like to send a get well message, just send it over to Marty at m.nicandro@bmg-group.com. That's m.nicandro, N-I-C-A-N-D-R-O, at bmg-group. Or you can just click the email button on our webpage and send it right over to him. And, of course, we also discuss impending 10,000,000% inflation expected in Venezuela, where a loaf of bread could soon cost $300,000 when converted. An ounce of gold, $120 million. That's what the International Monetary Fund is calling for. We also see signs of runaway inflation in their neighbor, Argentina, 32% officially right now. And then Brazil. We just added hyperinflation watch list, which seems to be gearing up there as well. And a little update on the neighborhood fire shield. I finished up a PDF, 10 pages or so long, but tons of pictures in APA format for the $729 neighborhood fire shield. If you know anyone in California where there are blazes, wouldn't it make you feel good to know that you have invested, you know, maybe for this Christmas, help them have a fire shield that can wrap up their houses? You know, even Joe Rogan had a house that we don't know yet whether or not it was lost in the inferno. Incredible opportunity to save pets, save jewelry, cash, bullion, artwork, and keepsakes, as well as homes, property, and even people. Help people. And then our good friends, of course, in Eastern Australia, 8,000 just evacuated. They're also having big infernos, of course, very arid conditions there as well. You know, I'm not anyway associated with any of these people. Just spent about a week researching this and putting it together because, frankly, I just can't stand the thought of, you know, hundreds of people going through this again. Let's pay it forward. Let's make this tragedy a blessing and not go through it again if we can. It's really unnecessary. It's such a simple solution. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear editorial. Our Q&A hotline, we'd like to field your questions and comments. Hope to get to them soon. 641-715-3900, mailbox number 514049. You can call right in. Please jot it down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone. 641-715-3900, mailbox number 514049. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week ahead of this weekend's big G20 meeting. At Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal shed just $3, finishing near the break-even point at $12.20. Silver gave back just 14 cents, ending at $14.24 an ounce. Shares shed less than a point, about 1% at $65. And black gold, though, bucked the trend, picking up 50 cents, closing at $50.91, just shy of $51. And oil was a big topic ahead of the G20, with the OPEC meeting scheduled for December 6, where Russia and OPEC are likely to hammer out a deal to reduce output. Weekly production, according to one media source, was flat at around 12 million barrels per day, and the Energy Information Administration noted that U.S. oil inventories increased a bit to about 4 million barrels. That's the 10th increase in a row, topping expectations. Another interesting note, palladium picked up 54. I've, of course, been calling this one since about $700 an ounce, came within $27 shy of parity with gold this week. We ended at $1,168, but not before coming within earshot of $1,200 at $1,198. The metal, of course, is used for catalytic converters, which are emissions-reducing devices on all cars today, primarily installed in China. They've been stockpiling the metal for quite some time. This is one of the few key uses for the metal, catalytic converters. But think of silver, the other industrial metal. Tens of thousands of inelastic uses for silver. Sure, there's considerably more of it, but is there really in stockpiles available? As China, India, and other key players and manufacturers begin to recognize, wait a minute, we need this in all our electronic products, all of our manufactured items, from keyboards to computers to laptops to iPhones to iPads to Androids to automobiles to major solar panels, up to an ounce in a 100-watt panel. I mean, it's just an incredible opportunity. How many years it'll take? Who knows? But with the inelastic demand that it tends to have, it can happen much more quickly than people think, as we've seen with palladium as well. Meanwhile, the top story moving the yellow metal, the weekend meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 meeting, on the heels of gold recording its second straight monthly gain. The leaders of the two world's economic superpowers will meet in Argentina, where the topic du jour is expected to be trade tariffs. Ironically, the meeting will take place in Argentina, as I mentioned, on the verge of hyperinflation, 32% annual price inflation there currently. There are some signs that our president will try to close the trade deal ahead of the meeting Friday and Saturday, which might have led to the big surge in U.S. equities this week, at least anticipation there or rumors flying. Both China and the U.S. headed to Buenos Aires are hopeful that we'll have a positive outcome, of course, which would likely lead to a massive U.S. equities rally, whereas negative meeting results could put equities under pressure and send the precious metals flying as a safe haven asset of last resort. U.S. officials hinted at boosting tariffs on China's $200 million worth of imported goods from 10% to 25%. That's a sizable tax if the meeting does not go well. Tariffs act as taxes, of course, pushing prices higher, particularly on the working and middle classes. In related news, the theme of higher prices and taxes adds pressure on Fed officials who continue to attempt to contain inflation and keep the domestic economy from overheating, with rate hikes and quantitative tightening now underway for well over a year. The current Fed funds futures at the Chicago Board of Options Exchange suggests a final rate hike at the December meeting is virtually baked into the, and then the rate hike cycle is expected to wrap up next year, with three more quarter point bumps higher in the overnight lending rate. In related domestic economic news, on Thursday, the U.S. Labor Department outlined initial weekly U.S. unemployment claims had increased by 10,000 to a seasonally adjusted 234,000. That was well above the 220,000 expected by analysts. The four-week moving average for new jobless claims also moved higher. However, the unemployment rate remains fixed at 3.7%, unchanged, near record lows, a very positive sign of a robust economy. Bottom line, precious metals. Well, despite the dollar pullback and amazing palladium rally, the precious metals continued to tread water this week. Likely on the G20 story, there might be some buy the rumor, sell the fact there as money flowed back into U.S. equities. I expect continued volatility, strong moves up and down, big price swings for several more weeks, maybe even months, amid the Diwali and Hindu festival of lights. Of course, we also have the Indian wedding season, of course, Christmas, Hanukkah, and all the others in the Western holidays as well. And China's New Year tend to be positive for the precious metals. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, nary a cloud was seen over the New York Stock Exchange this week. After 2 weeks of intense selling, investors bought up discounted shares on rumors of a possible resolution on the impending tariffs at this weekend's meeting. For the week, the Dow soared 1,252 points over 5%, finishing at 25,538. The S&P regained all of last week's losses, adding 127, 5%, and the NASDAQ picked up 5.5%. The top story pushing global equities higher this week, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell was far less hawkish on this Wednesday. He softened his stance. One media report noted that the chairman walked back his hawkish comments. The markets picked up on it and were quite pleased. Elsewhere, news that General Motors plans to slash 14,000 jobs, close 5 plants, and discontinue several key car models through a controversial restructuring plan to focus efforts on profitable SUVs and trucks, as well as electric cars. However, GM is one of the last movers really in this trend because Ford and Fiat Chrysler had already exited the sedan market. GM's stock leaped 5% Monday on the news. Some of the red-hot stocks in the news that I liked in the charts include Salesforce.com, a bit pricey here, but a big move higher. Ticker CRM headlined its software earnings rose 45%. And Workday, WDAY is the ticker, moved sharply higher on better revenue and profit expectations. The software for human capital management payroll tools company saw earnings increase 29%. Then Splunk, SPLK, reported 36% earnings per share, topping most expectations and raising guidance for January. Then one of my favorites in the charts, VMware, that's ticker VMW, reported third quarter revenue and profits way above expectations. Looking good. Box also looks good in the charts. Ticker BOX, solid third quarter revenues above estimates. And Vertex Pharmaceuticals, ticker VRTX, leaped Tuesday on news that its cystic fibrosis pill showed a lot of promise for patients with different issues, and this is a really tough illness. Guess, ticker GES, it missed earnings estimates but looks solid, and its stock leaped. And PRA Health Sciences, PRA, PRAH ticker, surged 3%, looking very solid in the charts. A provider of clinical trial services, had 8 winning days in a row. U.S. shares, bottom line. Last week, I called the bottom, and we hit it right on the head. And Harry S. Dent Jr. is my top guest next week. We spoke this Friday. He thinks the worst is over for U.S. equities. That's a positive. As we look at the USA Today Greed to Fear Index, this seems to agree with his sentiments, where the herd is extremely nervous here, but the pros are buying with both fists. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Well, we're so glad to have you back with us today. Another big GoldSeek.com radio episode and our featured guest, institutional advisor, editor-in-chief investment strategist of Charts and Markets. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Hello there, and it's good to be with you, Chris. You've always provided a lively show, and it's fun to be on. You know, I tell people that on an interview show, it's like playing tennis. You got to have somebody to lob the ball back. You do a good job.
I appreciate that. So start off the discussion with this interesting story. Little known. It's not even in the headlines. It's the last page of the Wall Street Journal. It deserves, I think, a little bigger billing, and that's 10 million% inflation in Venezuela. $1 now costs $100,000. So let's say you wanted to buy a loaf of bread for $2 or $3. All you need are $300,000. Of course, that's a bit of a stretch because we're talking about bolivars. It gives folks an idea, and you've got an interesting comment.
It's an act of desperation, the inflation. First of all, they want to pay themselves, so they start printing. And the disaster in Venezuela is actually instructive because it's happened so fast, like in about 20 years, of central planning. And when you come in with central planning, it screws things up, and then people become a little more dissatisfied. the economy's not doing so well, government revenues through taxation diminish, so then they do more central planning, and it's a dreadful feedback mechanism, and it's a classic pattern. They're doing the same as that Zimbabwe did, and of course, the classic in a leading European economy was the Weimar Republic inflation in the 1920s, and also, if you look around, you'll find that France at the same time was doing the same thing.
Yeah, we normally think of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, especially of the former communist bloc countries, but I didn't know France, because they had suffered so severely centuries of inflation. The original inflation, although I guess, yes, you can go back to China and Greece and Rome, but to me, the original somewhat modern example begins with France.
Beginning in 1790s.
Because they had a whole century there that led up to helping us out, and as you know, and early on in our revolution, because it was primarily financed by France, 100 million livres.
Called the continental currency, and that horrendous inflation. And older folks, now I'm old, but even my mom.
Not worth a continental.
Worth a continental. You don't hear it now, but that was... And nobody knew then, I think, knew what it meant. It was just something was worthless. It wasn't worth a continental. But maybe 100 years earlier than that, they knew in the States that it was that horrendous inflation. So, but those things are both compulsive and intentional. The government is destitute and needs money, so it prints it. And then it runs through a course where eventually the disorder... And the whole experiment collapses. And that was the case in Rome in the latter part of the 3rd century, right out to 300. And then Constantine came in and put the system back on the gold. So the inflation game was over. So it's always a pattern. And then a Greek writer, Aristophanes, in a play called The Frogs, wrote out what inflation was all about. So, whereas now I've been in the market so long, Chris, that I've been through the delusionary part about inflation where, and oh, I'll take this right back. It was 1965. I was in the research department of Canada's premier investment dealer, and they were the big power in the bond market. And this then in Canada and the U.S., the rate of inflation of the CPI was at getting up to 1%, which was getting concerning. So I was naive, and I had a meeting with the senior vice president of the bond department. With this inflation, if it gets any higher, that's really going to kill the return on the coupon and also mark the price of the bond down. And this very senior gentleman said, yes, Bob, you're right, but inflation only happens in lesser countries found in South America or Europe. He said that Canada and the United States has too much integrity to go to inflation.
I've heard similar arguments. It could never happen here because we have such an intense and strong and solid bond market. But, you know, let's take a look at Italy outside of, I guess, Northern Europe. It had probably the strongest bond market in all of Europe. Inflation still remains a threat there. But I would like to clear one quick thing up here for folks. We're not quite at 10 million. The IMF is calling for 1.4 million, and the author of this article is calling for 10 million, but we're on track in Venezuela. We have 32% now inflation, which to me is the heels of galloping slash hyperinflation in Argentina, their neighbor. Brazil is now starting to show some signs. So you see, this currency crisis mess tends to be contagious.
From lesser country to lesser country, but you got to look at the senior economy and the senior currency, which is U.S. and the dollar. In order to get the price inflation that these lesser countries have suffered, you would literally have to destroy the whole bond market, and before you would go to actually printing of. Now, you've had inflation through currency and credit issue, but we're in a pattern now where the opportunity to inflate anything is coming to an end in the senior currency. Now, I'll go through the pattern, is that you have a long period of economic expansion with rising global commodity prices, and then that ends with a huge speculative surge. One of the greatest was 1920. And then out of that crash, you had the guys at the Federal Reserve were very worried about weak wholesale prices. So the Fed was unusually easy through the mid-1920s, looking over their shoulder at very weak prices and not understanding inflation in financial assets. And even today, there's very few people understand it. So at any rate, a natural financial mania developed and blew out, as we all know, in September 1929. So then you had the hard crash and then the long contraction. But, Chris, that was number five in that pattern. The first was, and let's go back to London, where by the late 1600s, you had enough companies that were publicly held and traded, so you could call it a stock market. In 1692, you had the first financial market letter published in London. And 1694, you had the Bank of England, a bank of issue. So the modern world had arrived by 1700. And you had a huge commodity boom, 1711. And then you had a setback. And then out of that came speculation in financial assets with the South Sea Bubble, 1720. And then you had a long contraction. So the pattern is quite recognizable. A great bubble in commodities, then in financial assets, and then you get the contraction. So let's put it in another way, that while tangible assets are going up, the public hoards tangible assets and commodities. That ended in 1980 and set up a new financial era, which began in 1982 and it's continued. But within this, you also had that huge commodity boom in 2008, when crude was up to 147 and commodity indexes were at the highest they'd ever been. And 9 years later, the time from that peak in commodities to the peak in the stock market in January. Now, that's when global stock markets peaked and the New York Stock Exchange composite peaked in January. That was 9 years and 7 months. Then also the commodity index by a month, by the monthly post, is available for 1920. And that boom from the peak in commodities in 1920 to September 1929 ran for 9 years and 5 months. So the timing is remarkably close. Now, with the bubble commodity boom in 1864, I couldn't find a commodity index plotted by month. But 9 years later, you had the great commodity boom, or the great stock boom of 1873 blew out and crashed, and you were followed by a lengthy contraction. Now, here's where you then had a sophisticated economic community then, and England was the senior economy, and the contraction was continuous and unusually weak. So senior economist in England in 1884 started calling that one the Great Depression, and it lasted till 1896. But it's interesting, is when I was going through all those economic history, is that senior economists in England were still debating how the Great Depression of 1873 to 1896 could have been prevented as late as 1939. And then we've got another depression here now. So the economic literature on financial matters is quite interesting. So anyways, what we're looking for now is that this seems that the recent financial mania blew itself out in January and in setting new lows recently with exchanges all around the world. The bear market has been set, and in which case you're going to have serious deflation in the senior currency terms. Now, here's the other thing from financial history, is that in every post-bubble contraction, the senior currency has become chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. That's just the way it works. So the line that I used, Chris, when I was just first starting to go to financial institutions in our presentation was slides, and it included one that said, no matter how much the Fed prints, stocks and bonds will outperform commodities. And in 1982, that was highly controversial because the fund managers then had only finally figured out that inflation was caused by the Fed. But then this is the part, as I said, very few people understand what inflation in financial assets means. And you had, like, the gold community with the boom out to 2011, it was $1,900 gold. The real price of gold was going up. Stocks were going to the moon. And yet most of them would say, oh, the price of gold is suppressed by the government. And then we had all our technical stuff saying, hey, the top of the market, just like gold and silver in 1980, and that it was dangerous, stuff like that. So, but at any rate, within this big pattern is when you have a financial bubble, a mania like we've been in, gold's real price goes down, which it has done, and gold stocks underperform, which they have done. And then out of this, once we're through the beat up here in the stock market, which it became quite oversold recently, and there could be some relief for a month or so, but generally I think we're in a bear market. So out of this comes a great bull market for gold stocks, not because of inflation, but because of deflation, whereby most commodities and wages and costs fall relative to the price of gold, so the gold miners make money. Chris, this is phenomenal how this pattern keeps recurring, and I'm highly confident that it will continue the basic pattern where we will go into a great bull market for gold. But it won't be the old 1970s recipe whereby the Fed is evil, gold's going to go up, stuff like that. So where in 2011 gold pundits were calling for $10,000 gold, what has happened is that stocks and bonds went to the equivalent of $10,000 gold, you know what I mean? And this is where the play has been, and now that it's rolling over, the exciting part for the precious metals is ahead of us, and I'm sure we can get the entry point on it, but to get the idea of deflation is you want to look at the great gold rushes in history. You had California in 1840s, which was a depression bottom. So high unemployment, men not working, and you also had the price of gold in real terms high. So when you make a gold discovery, the world goes crazy. Now then, the next depression bottom, as I said, was 1895, 1896, when the gold's real price was high and global unemployment was high. In a depression, people are out of work. So then when a gold discovery is made, if you get this huge rush, people go there. So that, then you had in the late 1890s, you had the Klondike, and you also had gold discoveries near Melbourne in Australia. So there's a long-term pattern there. Actually, I remember now that the first gold rush in a depression was in the 1690s, and it was in Brazil, the Preto Ouro gold rush. So, Chris, we're going to have a gold rush, but it hasn't started yet, and it'll take a number of years there. So we will have rising gold stocks, and there will be junior exploration stocks. There will be discoveries, and the fun part of it is that the stock market will recognize this, and the gold stocks will become the premier game.
You've given us a lot of material here. We've covered an awful lot of bases. So try to just focus on the last part. I think the real takeaway here for the soundbite focused listener, those of us with ADD, attention, or I guess it's ADHD today. But one of the key takeaways here was Bob Hoy likes precious metals equities relative to the overpriced, overloved, if you will, stocks and related stocks and shares that have been essentially priced to perfection in a world that suddenly we find out the emperor may not have remembered his underwear. That right there, I think, is one very important soundbite you've left with us, and it's a juicy morsel of cuisine for cogitation for our precious metals aficionados. Oh, what a wordsmith your host is today. Once again, that's at chartsandmarkets.com.
www.bobhoy.com, and it comes up.
Okay.
But just Google Bob Hoy, and you'll get it. As you know, Chris, and you can get in touch with us, Bob Hoy, just do bobhoy.com, www.bobhoy.com.
Bob Hoy, institutional advisor. We'll talk soon.
Good to talk. Bye-bye.
Peter Schiff, chairman of SchiffGold.com and author of several bestsellers. You were complaining about the air conditioning earlier, and we were scratching our heads here in the studio. What's he talking about, air conditioning, in November, almost December?
No, well, I mean, it's nice to be out here in Puerto Rico. You know, it's beautiful weather and low taxes. So temperature's high, taxes are low. Good. Yeah, if anybody is tired of paying high taxes and they don't like paying federal income taxes, check out Puerto Rico. I mean, it's a great place to relocate and eliminate most of your U.S. tax burden.
There's another key point to this narrative that you bring up on the precious metals. It wasn't just a love affair with that almost no non-existent market, cryptos, okay, that started to stick its head out last year. The real story here was U.S. and also global equities. Now, that is over, at least in the near term. We've seen several months of intense selling, a little bit of fear in the volatility index, a little bit of concern has entered the market. So some of that money is obviously looking for a safe haven.
Just the U.S. I mean, and emerging markets. So those stocks have started to come up recently. So they're starting to look like they've washed out because they actually, a lot of the emerging market stocks are up so far this quarter. And that's obviously not the case for the U.S. stocks and particularly the, you know, the NASDAQ type stocks, FANG stocks. So we're starting to see some good relative strength now starting in the emerging markets. But for a long time, the U.S. has been the only game in town because the dollar has been strong and everybody's been talking about the biggest economic boom in U.S. history, which is all a bunch of nonsense, but people still talk about it. And with the dollar rising, that has caused a lot of money to come into the U.S., but people are overlooking the fundamentals. I mean, we just printed the worst trade deficit in U.S. history today for our goods. We have never lost worse on trade. This is the worst we've ever done. In fact, this most recent trade figures, we had a plunge in exports. Imports went up. It's a complete disaster. So the trade deficit is running out of control. The budget deficits are on fire. We're going to have bigger deficits under Trump during a recovery or during growth than we had under Obama during the Great Recession. And so that means the next economic downturn, which I think is going to happen so overdue, but probably should happen by 2019, but we're going to have $3 trillion a year budget deficits in the next U.S. recession. And so when the Fed has to surprise all the markets by slashing rates back to zero, which is what it's going to do in one big swoop, they're just going to go all the way to zero, you know, like without pass and go, and they're going to relaunch quantitative easing. And this time it's going to have to be much bigger than the last three combined. They're going to have to probably do a couple hundred billion, maybe 300 billion a month. They went down to zero very, very quickly. They didn't go down a quarter of minutes. They just slashed rates slowly.
What are they going to do? Are they going to go into negative interest rates like we saw in China and in the Eurozone?
That's a tough call. I mean, real rates, of course, I mean, real rates are still negative. I mean, they've never moved real rates positive yet. The inflation rate, even the way the government measures it, is higher than the nominal interest rate. So we've had negative real rates the entire time. But whether we'll actually have negative nominal rates, I mean, that's a tough call if we're actually going to go that deep into the rabbit hole. But I do think we're going to go to zero. And the reason I think we're going to get there so quickly is because the Fed is likely going to be blindsided by the economic data. And generally, the last thing that happens is the big uptick in unemployment, right? Because recessions don't start because people get laid off. People get laid off because we're in a recession. The businesses never anticipate the recession by laying people off. Once they get blindsided by it, they react by laying people off. So the last thing to happen is you get a big spike in unemployment. You get the collapse of non-farm payrolls. And so the Federal Reserve is just watching employment as a sign. But by the time they see, you know, negative 500,000, negative a million jobs, and we're going to get that, there's going to be big layoffs. Unemployment is going to spike up. They're still going to have interest rates way up there.
That's the typical economic cycle. Okay, I'm with you. You know, we've had a big boom, so you get a big bust. I'm with you. However, Mnuchin and our current Fed head, Powell, do not strike me in any way similar to Bernanke and Paulson. You know, the last team, Paulson was a seasoned financial individual, and Bernanke had studied the Great Depression. That was his big background. I don't see any parallels there. So what I'm afraid is going to happen this time is that they're going to drop the ball. Unlike, let's say, 2007, 2008, 2009, where they obviously had to act quickly or the whole system would grind to a halt. I don't see that leadership.
I mean, yes, he's not as much of an academic as some of his predecessors, not really an economist. And so that could be a positive. But if you listen to the things that he's saying, he is so oblivious to the problems that exist, just like predecessors. And I think he's grossly, you know, underestimating or overestimating the ability of the U.S. economy to withstand higher interest rates. He doesn't understand the degree to which the U.S. has been addicted to ultra-cheap money and the enormity of the debt and the problems that we have. Now, maybe he does understand these things, and he's just lying about it. I mean, you never know, because a lot of these Fed chairmen feel that their job is just to be cheerleaders and to just be optimistic no matter what, because they're afraid of you know, being pessimistic and then creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, where if the Fed believes the economy is weakening, they're afraid to acknowledge that because they think if they tell the truth, then businesses and consumers will react to that by, you know, preparing for a weaker economy, and the preparation is what's going to create it. So they try to keep the confidence going as long as possible to try to delay the onset of the recession. But of course, when they do that, they simply, you know, worsen the severity of the recession that is inevitably going to start. But I am sure that the Federal Reserve is going to react to the next crisis exactly the same way it's reacted to all of the previous crises. Now, if I'm wrong, then it's going to be a different type of collapse, because if the Fed doesn't do that, then the stock market's going to completely implode, not just 50%, but 80 or 90%. Real estate prices are going to collapse, and the government is going to have to default on not only its obligations to Social Security recipients or pensioners, they're going to have to default on Treasury bonds. And, of course, banks are going to fail, and there's going to be no money there because the FDIC is broke. So I don't know that Powell has the guts to actually force all those things to happen, but all those things would happen if we don't go back to zero and go back to quantitative easing. So, you know, my money is still on that the Fed is going to monetize all this and do what's politically expedient, not what's the right thing to do for the long-term health of the economy. I mean, there's no precedent really of the Fed doing that since Volcker. And, I don't think we've got a Volcker situation. Plus, you also have to realize the political gravity of this. If all this hits the fan in the next 2 years, the Democrats already have the House. They're going to get the Senate, and they're going to get the White House, and it's not going to be, you know, a Bill Clinton or even a Barack Obama. It's going to be a Bernie Sanders type. It's going to be a total socialist president, and he's going to have a mandate to dismantle capitalism, because capitalism is going to get the blame, and he's talking about less government and tax cuts and deregulation, and all that's going to get the blame for this collapse. And the solution is going to be for a complete government takeover of the economy. It's a very dangerous situation.
Okay, let's talk about the G20 meeting. Obviously, we have our U.S. president and China's Xi Jinping. They're meeting, the two economic superpowers will be meeting. And obviously, the topic du jour, tariffs and trade wars. Why don't you speak to the significance of whether or not they hammer out a deal and just what that might mean for the markets and precious metals?
I think the stock market has started the bear market, so most likely the stock market is going down in the U.S. regardless of a deal. I think if there's no deal and the tariffs actually kick in, it'll probably be much worse for the stock market than if there is a deal. And I do think that there will be some kind of deal, because I don't think Trump can afford to not make a deal. I mean, as much as he wants to talk about how our economy can withstand these 25% tariffs.
Obviously, the U.S. is on track to impose 25% tariffs or taxes, if you will, on $200 billion of Chinese imports. Currently, we're at 10%. That's due to go into place January 1st if they don't hammer out a deal this week. Tell us more.
Yeah, and remember, the tariffs are not on the Chinese. They're on Americans who want to buy Chinese imported products. Consumer has to pay the cost of the tariff. And, you know, a lot of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and they really can't keep buying if everything gets 25% more expensive. They just don't have that much extra cash. So I think that there'd be a lot of damage in the U.S. if those tariffs were actually imposed. So I don't think Trump is going to chance it. So I think there's going to be some kind of deal. But, you know, just like the rebranding of NAFTA, I mean, nothing is going to change, right? The U.S. trade deficits are not going to go away. Nothing will have been accomplished. Even if Donald Trump wants to claim credit for having actually done something, nothing is actually going to be done. The only thing that will be done is we would have been spared the 25% tariffs that he himself was threatening to impose. But, you know, what everybody overlooks in the situation is how America is benefiting in the short run, not in the long run, but in the short run, how we have benefited from these massive trade deficits. Because what the trade deficit means is we get to consume stuff that we did not have to produce. See, the hard part is making the stuff, because there you need to expend resources, materials, labor, stuff like that. Just consuming the product, that's the fun part, right? And so what Americans have got, we've got all the good things without having to do any of the heavy lifting, right? It's like getting a paycheck without having to show up for work. I mean, most Americans, if they could get paid and not have to go to work, you know, they would take that. But what the Chinese are doing is they're working and they're not getting paid. They're making all this stuff and they're not getting anything. So they're the ones that are losing, and we're the ones that have been winning in the short run, that our standard of living has been artificially enhanced by the willingness of China and everybody else to supply us with merchandise that we don't pay for, that we don't produce exports to, you know. And so we get to live beyond our means. We get to enjoy a standard of living that is disproportionate to what we would otherwise be entitled to if we didn't have these trade deficits. Balanced trade You know, we would have to import a lot less. We'd have to start making a lot more, but then we'd have to start saving and investing, and we couldn't keep spending.
Right. This is a key point that we've brought up here on the show, especially with Dr. Stephen Leib from time to time. Look, our leadership, they don't seem to make the connection. They don't get it, as they say today. What would be your recipe if you were thrust into political position to where you would try to reverse this mindset, this groupthink that we have here, and emulate some of China's success?
I want to emulate our own success. I mean, I really liked the idea of Trump, make America great again. I'm all for that. So we need to restore America to her former glory by recapturing the freedom that we lost. And what we have to do is rechain the government back up in the Constitution. We need to shrink the government back down to its constitutional size so that we can have maximum liberty and maximum prosperity. And, you know, capitalism is a wonderful thing. And with all the modern technology at our disposal, we could grow this economy probably like it's never grown before. We could probably have 10% a year growth rates if we really had a free market capitalism. But, you know, we have a lot of dismantling to do before we get from here to there. And, of course, you know, there's going to be some short-term pain as we deflate asset bubbles and as a lot of people have to be hit with reality. You've been counting on Social Security, you're not going to get it. You've been counting on Medicare, you're not going to get it. You've been counting on a government pension, you're not going to get it.
You might actually get the checks. That doesn't mean there'll be any purchasing power left.
But I don't want to give people worthless checks. I want to preserve the purchasing power of the dollar. I don't want to destroy it so politicians can pretend to keep their promises. But, you know, if we can get rid of, let's say we had a country where we can turn back the clock 100 years and get the government back down to 5% or so of GDP total, state, federal, and local. If we can eliminate all income taxes, not just corporate taxes, individual taxes, eliminate the Social Security tax, payroll tax, get rid of almost all the federal taxes that we now pay. Imagine the prosperity we can have in this country. Get rid of all these agencies, all these rules and regulations. So if somebody wants to start up a business, they just start it up. They don't need all this permission from all these regulators. They don't need a fortune. They could, you know, they could just, you know, start up a company.
Even traditional economics, I mean, pages torn right out of, you know, macro and micro economics textbooks today, recognize and highlight and embolden the thought that transfer payments and some of these unnecessary taxing, I mean, they're incredibly inefficient means of trying to, you know, benefit those who really need help. It just doesn't work for the long term. Now, in short term, when you have economic disruptions, it does work, but merely in the short term. And the problem is, once you set these machines in motion, you never can easily dismantle them, as you're, you know, advising us to do today.
When you set up government agencies to help the poor, they don't really help the poor. They help the government, and they help, you know, impoverish the poor. They help perpetuate poverty.
If they'd stuck with the early mandate that this is a temporary fix, remember Social Security, remember that about a century ago? The whole idea there was this is a short-term fix, we're going to dismantle it.
And it was supposed to be temporary, but look, it's like a camel's nose under the tent. You can't let government do that. Look, the best way to deal with truly true poverty or people in need is private charity. I mean, that is the best way to really cares, individuals spending their own money, are really care about helping people. They want to give people a hand up. They don't want to perpetuate poverty.
That was the original concept from the Scottish pastors, a safety net there for widowers and their children. Okay, that was the original concept. It's sound 250 years later. It's still the only thing that really works. For sudden emergencies, I mean, there is a place for government to help. But you're right. Long term, it's inefficient.
What government can do is defense, national defense. I mean, so, you know, the government can have the Army and the Air Force, and I don't think we need the Space Force. I think we got plenty, the branches we got. But government can do national defense. And then on a local level, government is there to protect individual liberty and private property. That's what it's there for. It's there to make sure that other people don't steal from you. So government is not there to give you things. Government is just there to protect the things that you have. That's the limited role of government. So if you want something, go out and earn it. But you can't vote for government to steal from somebody and then give the money that they've stolen to you in exchange for your vote. Government is there to preserve liberty, protect liberty, life, liberty, and property, to make sure that our inalienable rights are protected. But you don't have the right to a job. You don't have the right to health care. You don't have the right to education. You just have the right to keep what you have.
So you don't like up to, let's say, I don't know, 12th grade education in the United States? You're not a fan of public education?
I think the private sector does a much better job, and to the extent that the government doesn't waste money on public education. See, parents, I trust parents to educate their kids. Parents care more about their kids than government bureaucrats, and parents will send their kids to school. It's not, you know, and if there were no public schools, parents would send their kids to private schools. And in fact, if there were no public schools, we'd have a lot more private schools because there'd be competition. There'd be a free market. People would be setting up schools to compete for educational dollars. You know, it's not like, look, parents buy clothes for their kids. Kids aren't starving to death. Parents buy food for their kids. Parents are going to educate their kids. They want their kids to succeed. And I would rather have parents choose among private providers of education who actually care about delivering quality products because they're subject to free market forces than a bunch of bureaucrats. The public education system is run for the benefit of the teachers and the administration.
Just circle back to the Spider Gold ETF, ticker GLD. You know, we saw massive inflows recently, and this is a trend we've seen in recent months. $472 million of inflows last month. This is a solid indication that maybe the institutions are starting to see something ahead for the yellow metal.
You know, I think they're still oblivious. I think if institutions were really moving into GLD, it would be a lot higher. And I think it will be a lot higher because I do think eventually people are going to see that the dollar is going to weaken and that inflation is going to be a big problem. Because as everybody assumes that a recession will take care of inflation, that's wrong, right? Inflation is not caused by economic growth, and a recession does not cure inflation. In fact, if anything, recessions are inflationary under normal circumstances, because what happens during a recession? Production goes down, so the supply of goods goes down, but governments have to print more money because the deficits go up. So you have more money printing, and you have a reduction in output. That is inflation. That is prices going up. And I think this next recession is going to be stagflation. It is going to be like the 1970s, only more so. And so I think that when people realize that inflation is going to be a huge problem and the Fed is not going to put out the fire, but it's going to throw gasoline on it, people are going to scramble for real inflation hedges, and the best one is gold, and I think gold is going to take off. And, you know, it is so underowned. I mean, nobody owns it. I mean, your listeners own it, and my clients own it, and I own some, and you own some. But believe me, I mean, you go to your typical, firm, asset management company, even hedge funds, they don't own it. The institutions, the endowments, your typical brokerage client. I mean, we've been in a bear market in gold for so long, right, that nobody has it.
There will be the listeners out there saying, you know, we've listened to Peter, we've listened to Chris for years, and we've heard the story from Nick Barishoff at, you know, Bullion Management Group, that less than 0.5% of pension funds that have anywhere from $4 trillion worth of assets have any money invested in the precious metals. And yet, year after year, they continue to ignore it.
I don't only own gold. I own a lot of assets around the world. I mean, I don't tell people to just have all your money in gold because one day it's going to go up. I just tell people have some money in gold because one day it will go up. I just don't know exactly when. I know obviously we're a lot closer to that point now than we were in the past, simply because the time has gone by and the problems have got a lot bigger. But, you know, we had a big bull market in gold from 2001 to 2011. Gold went up, you know, from under 300 to 1900. And I can tell you that before that bull market started, nobody was bullish on gold. It was the dot-com era. It was the new economy. You know, nobody wanted to have anything to do with gold. And people thought the U.S. was going to pay off the national debt. We were going to have surpluses as far as the eye can see. Institutions actually got short gold in 2001 for the first time. You know, gold had just gone through a 20-year bear market because it had peaked out in 1980. And then, of course, gold took off from under 300 to 1900. And, you know, it's been quiet since then. We've had a correction, you know, but I think we're building a base, you know, and we're getting ready for the next big move, which is going to take gold to $5,000 to $10,000 an ounce.
It sounds to me like your scenario parallels ours here. I mean, we see, you know, obviously around the world, the Fed's colleagues are now going to pick up the ball and start their quantitative tightening. Okay, the reverse of quantitative easing, at least to some degree. That's going to jack up rates. It's going to make the U.S. dollar a little less competitive. We could see an inversion of the yield curve maybe by summer of next year, or at least a continued flattening. So you bring all these pieces together, and you're likely going to see that downward push on rates. That bodes well for, you know, the yellow metal, which prefers negative real interest rates. We really haven't had, I think you'd agree, for the last year or two. So, I mean, it might put us back into that bullish territory. Closing thoughts on U.S. equities and precious metals.
Well, right now, I mean, I'm not even seeing what the news is, but everything is going up as we speak. You know, the Dow is up better than 400 points now on the day, but gold is starting to take off. Gold stocks are starting to jam. I'm looking at a lot of gold stocks up 3-5% today. I know Powell is talking, so maybe he said something that was interpreted as dovish, but I'm not seeing any real movement in the dollar yet. The dollar is still relatively flat, but everything is up today. Stocks are way up. Bitcoin is way up. Gold stocks are way up, so the oil's flat on the day. I still think this is a bear market rally in U.S. stocks. I think that the money that's going to be made in the stock market is going to be overseas, emerging markets that have been beaten down. I think China, you know, Chinese market had a huge drop. I think if you're going to buy stocks, tech stocks in particular, the Chinese names are the ones to go for if you want to go into those stocks. But I think that everybody's got this thing wrong. I think China is the one that's going to come out on top when it comes to the trade war or the aversion of one, either way. But I think those names look good. And the oil stocks, you know, oil's been beaten down, and I think that oil's a great buy, you know, around $50 a barrel. I don't expect it to go much lower than that. I mean, obviously, we were close to 80 a couple months ago. But I think once the dollar starts to turn, which is what I expect, that's going to cause oil prices to rise because that's going to lead to increased demand globally for oil, and it's going to take all the pressure off of the emerging markets because it's the strength of the dollar and the anticipation that the dollar will keep strengthening that has been undermining those economies. But once they are relieved of that pressure, it's going to be, I think, a big boom.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add there is if your thesis is correct, and it, again, parallels my thoughts here, we do see West Texas Intermediate crude continue to reverse this temporary theme and start to move back up 70, 80, 90, 100. And that's going to obviously put more pressure on U.S. equities. We need that energy. The energy is an important component of corporate profits. Start to change models on earnings for the earnings seasons and earnings estimate. Why don't you tell people more about Schiff Gold, any other contact information?
Yeah, look, Schiff Gold, that's my gold company. I run it now in partnership with Gold Money. We've got the best prices online for bullion. We don't do numismatics. We're just trying to get you the most gold for your money. And so shiftgold.com. Also, you can set up an account at goldmoney.com if you do want to have gold in a way that you can, you know, access it with a debit card and carry your gold around with you in your wallet. Take it out, you know, take it with you wherever you go because you have access 24 hours a day to spend it. And, you know, Monet, you know, check out Monet.com where you can buy gold jewelry. Basically, depending on the piece, sometimes it's 15% above spot, sometimes 25%, depending on the intricacy of the piece. But all the jewelry is made from pure gold, 24 karat gold. You know exactly how much gold you're getting, and you know you can sell it back to the company whenever you want for the value of the gold. So you know you can buy jewelry, but not blow all your money because you're still preserving it in gold. If you've got more money, if you've got a stock portfolio, you want me to manage money for you, whether it's a retirement account, IRA, whatever, pension or personal account, I manage money through Europe Civic Asset Management and my broker-dealer, Europe Civic Capital. Our website is europac.com, EUROPAC.com, and our phone number is there if you want to give us a call. But I do think that there is a tremendous potential not only to avoid losses in the U.S. as the dollar goes down, but to actually profit from the dollar's demise. I think there's going to be some huge winners from the realignment of purchasing power as the dollar loses its reserve currency status. You know, Americans who have been living beyond their means are going to have to, you know, take a big notch down. But I think the rest of the world, which has lived beneath its means to make America living above its means possible, you're going to see some real wealth accumulation, and it's possible for investors to take advantage of that.
If we do see that bear market in U.S. equities that you're calling for, which still looks quite possible, if we do get a final washout, are you advising clients to maybe steer clear of the XU and wait for that bottom? Or do you see some opportunities for people to sort of hop away from the high-flying fangs into something a little more conservative like the gold and silver shares?
I think there's a lot of value in gold stocks. I mean, I manage a value fund, and that value fund right now has about a 20-25% weighting to gold stocks. I mean, so that's not part of the mandate. It's not a gold fund. I mean, I have a gold fund also that's 100% gold stocks. But I think gold stocks are super cheap. I mean, they're as cheap as they've ever been. And so even for people who aren't necessarily gold bugs, they should still be buying these gold stocks. They can sell them on the next double or triple. I mean, I think they're going a lot higher than that, but obviously if they double or triple, they won't be the steals they are now. So even people who are not really long-term gold bugs, I think could benefit by having an allocation now to a sector that is ridiculously undervalued relative to historic, you know, prices. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you want to gamble on stocks, I mean, I think you have a lot more upside relative to downside in the gold stocks than you do in the FANG stocks.
Let's look forward to seeing how much of this actually plays out early 2019.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. There's a mind-reading illusion I perform in my motivational talk on leadership and change that revolves around the use of a verbal lie detector test. Someone randomly draws a poker hand of five cards, shuffles those cards, and merely thinks of one of those cards. They don't point to it, they don't write it down, they merely think of a card. I ask them to slowly call out the names of all the cards in their hand and lie about the card they are thinking of. In other words, if they're thinking of the Three of Spades, they might call it the Four of Hearts, but tell the truth about the other cards. 9 out of 10 times, I'm able to discern not only what card they lied about, but actually tell them the card they are thinking of. If you've ever seen it or actually participated in it, it's pretty darn amazing. Over the years, I've seen many political types get nervous when they realized a lie could actually be detected verbally. And even more so when they realized that sometimes a lie could be penetrated so as to discover what they were actually thinking. This is not something I underscore very often, but did want to bring it up because of the endless lies of omission, and outright censorship that is being exhibited in the communication wars of mainstream media, and now social media. Understand that many of the political scenarios that seem important today are forgotten tomorrow. Much of the yellow journalism clickbait that provokes us, often on a daily basis, to click through and read or watch anticlimactic stories that often take us down roads to nowhere until the next one pops up. And we start all over again, day in and day out. There's no doubt that some of these stories matter. But remember, debt and the management thereof, whether at the personal, corporate, state, national, or global level, debt is the nemesis and the driver of all things political, all things economic, and all things personal. Most everything you see in the media is a distraction. A distraction from unacknowledged, unaccounted for, and ultimately unpayable debt. What goes up, like stock markets and runaway real estate prices, will come down. As my friend Greg Manarino says, all things will eventually correct to fair market value. And that fair market value may be very different from what you are currently being led to believe. Politics and the media are filled with highly sophisticated and convincing liars. Be alert and be aware, now more than ever. because you want to avoid becoming a casualty in the next global correction to fair market value in everything. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.